My name is Tony White. I'm an alcoholic. Due to God's grace, the message of Alcoholics Anonymous is given to me through strong and loving sponsorship. Haven't found it necessary to take a drink since July 8th, 2003, and for that I'm eternally grateful. I want to thank the board, my fellow board members, brothers and sisters on the board, and Dirk and Milton. Milton, thank you for this opportunity. I can't say that, sitting out there that you kind of like, I think I might like to do that maybe one time. And then that time comes and you go, I don't know if I want it, but we'll roll with it. I guess in a general way to share what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I originally grew up in Evanston, Illinois. It's a city right above Chicago, right on Lake Michigan. My father was a police officer there, and my mother worked for the post office. They both, when they retired, well, mom with a little break in between, but they both were public servants for 32 years each. They divorced when I was like 3 or 4 years old. And I can only go to, I had kid think, that extreme selfishness and self-centeredness. But I don't know if it's so much selfishness and self-centeredness. I think as a kid, the center of your universe are your parents. And what had happened that day is that the way the neighborhood was is that the different kids in the neighborhood, so we would pick somebody's backyard or someone's house to hang out in, and one of the older kids had come over, and he had Kool-Aid, but it was a new kind of Kool-Aid because it had the sugar in it. It wasn't the where you had to add the extra. And it was green. And so he's pouring it in our hands and, of course, it's sucking that stuff up. And so I guess I look like, a pre-Kermit the Frog with all this green on my face and on my hands. And my mother says, go upstairs and walk to the bathroom and wash that off. And so I go upstairs and I'm washing my hands and I look over on the edge of the bathtub and there's a can over there with green powder. And so I grab it and pour it in my hand, and I guess right when I put it to my tongue and I got that faith, that nasty mom came in, and of course it was Comet. And it's poison, it scared her to death. And go to your room. There's some yelling and hollering a short time, I'm in the room, a short time after that, my mother's mother, my grandmother lived on the south side of Chicago. It was about a 45-minute ride. And I heard her voice downstairs. Man, she was the center of my universe. Nene. I called her Nene because she said grandma was for old people. So I was always referred to her as Nene. But I also remembered mom said, don't come downstairs. And so I looked out the window and saw the car, saw the red Impala. And there was an argument downstairs and raised voices and a slam of the door. And my dad comes upstairs and he says, your mother's going to go live with your grandmother on the south side for a while. And I don't know if it was immediate or real soon after that. It was my fault because I had eaten that Comet. When they eventually got divorced, and mom chose, she had, of course, at that time, there was, neither one of them was involved in anything that, would be detrimental or say that they would be a bad parent. They just didn't get along. But mom was going to go live on the south side, and she let me stay with dad and his mother, my grandma Eula, in Evanston. I didn't find out until later on. Honestly, I felt like she kind of left me there. But it's not to say that I didn't love my father. But when I asked her about that, she said, years later, she's like, I just felt that you would have a better opportunity, had a better life if you lived in Evanston instead of being on the south side of Chicago. that's not a testament of love, I don't know what is. When my father passed away at the end of October of 2010, and when Dad passed, he was 32 years sober. Literature talks about that life with an alcoholic would make any wife or child neurotic. And there was no physical abuse. I mean, he drank and he was moody and he had a temper and would slam doors. And the guy was 6'4" and he carried a gun, and so that's kind of scary enough in itself, being a police officer. You just at the house, you just really never knew what was going to happen. It was just kind of unpredictable. I found comfort and refuge and companionship and love with the kids in the neighborhood and friends and other kids that I went to school with, you know, just away from the house. I played drums starting in fourth grade up through junior high school, or up through my senior year in high school. Played soccer in junior high school and high school. Also pole vaulted in high school. As you can see, I'm kind of a thin build. When I was younger, I look back at the pictures, it's like I'm all leg and no torso, and with these little chicken legs. And in junior high school, I was having headaches, and so I went and got my eyes checked and got glasses. And you know, back then the cool glasses to have were the wireframe aviator ones. And my stepmother and my father were getting remarried, and she's like, "No, you can't have wireframes; you'll break them." So they were tortoise shell, bifocal, photo gray glasses. In seventh grade, I was a walking birth control pill. I'm gonna take a step back. Every other weekend, I would go to the south side of Chicago. My grandmother, up until the mid-60s, owned a bar on the south side. She had sang and danced at the Apollo Theater in New York City in a different club. She was kind of in and out of the entertainment. She was a beautiful little woman. She's probably about that tall. She's a fire. Oh, man, you didn't mess with Addie. Incredible strength. And so it was, she had a numbers game at her apartment. The liquor was always flowing, the music was always going when there were parties. Loved being down there for New Year's. The pimps and the players and the hustlers were down there, and that night, you guys walking around with a big old amount of money in their pocket with a rubber band wrapped around it. Evanston, my dad's dad was the first black sergeant on the Evanston Police Force. He was Catholic. Now, my grandmother was Catholic and he was Methodist. And my grandfather's brother was a Baptist minister. Up until my father was 18 years old, he was in church at least three times a week. There was structure, there were morals, there was love. You conducted yourself in a certain way. This is back when something as simple as the curtains being open always, unless there was a problem or someone sick in the home. The front door was, we never locked the front door back then. My grandfather was a man of great respect. He passed away before I was born. I would growing up hearing stories about him and just thinking, man, those are shoes I'll never be able to fill. And the same thing with my father, even with his drinking. My dad was just, he was just Hollywood pretty. And before he and my stepmother got married, I mean, even my teachers would ask me, "Does your father have a girlfriend?" It's like, no. You know, oh, your father's so handsome, man, all this stuff. But, you know, and so in Evanston, with the structure, I just became a chameleon, and would be that way when I was at an environment, and then being on the south side of Chicago, and I don't pull off hip, slick, cool, pimp, player, hustler very well, but that internal kind of compass that it is okay to be me until I got here with you guys and worked some steps and God revealed who I really was. Always being what I thought you wanted me to be so that I would think that I would be okay. So I'm a chameleon, honestly scared to death. No really internal compass or kind of idea who I am. Coming from the divorce, blame myself for it, unconsciously or consciously. And then, again, being this skinny guy with the glasses, and then I had this big old, I had an afro, and it, just, you know, looked like a black tip Q-tip with all that hair and so skinny. It's my sophomore year in high school, and I had messed around with a little bit of weed before then, and had drank a little bit, and the pretty girl had a party at her house, and it wasn't because I was a popular guy, it's because I was a soccer player, and we all got invited to go to the party, and and I'm drinking Stroh's beer that night. And I'm sitting on the steps, and it's a ranch-style house, and it kind of opens up down, and everybody's down there. And one of my buddies, he said something to me, and he ribbed me about something, and I threw something back at him, jabbed him, and everybody laughed. And he fired something back, and I fired something back at him again, and everybody laughed again, and I'm kind of like, I'm kind of digging this. This is nice. And sipping on the Stroh's beer, and nothing happened, but it was just that with this, but the pretty girl whose house it was, she came over and she sat down next to me on the steps and said, "Tony, you know, you're kind of cute. You should have a girlfriend." No one had, girl had never spoken to me like that before, and all that positive reinforcement and that warm fuzzy going on from the Stroh's beer. I went home that night. And if any of you have seen Monty Python and the Holy Grail, when I closed my eyes, there was like this crystal goblet with this gold light shining in my mind's eye. It's just kind of floating there, just kind of, ooh. I made a deep personal commitment to Stroh's beer that night. Because the black Q-tip was gone. All that fear was gone. All that I'm good. Hell, I didn't dance that night, but it wasn't too much long after that before I have a couple of slow gin fizzes and get out there on the dance floor. It made all that different go away. And I've heard it, I love this description of it, but you know, I identify that moment as that's when alcohol began making all the decisions in my life. What activities, what social activities, the people that I hung out with, if there wasn't drinking and chasing girls and dancing at parties, dancing in someone's basement on the weekend, dancing to the late 70s R&B, I didn't want to have anything to do with it. I'm 50 and this is the 80s and I wanted to be still wanted to be that hip-slicking cool guy and engaged in other substances that were popular at that time. For us, want to be hip-slicking cool guys. Kind of helped me get ready to do or be placed in a position to do something different a whole lot sooner. And I got it. Went away to college at the University of Arkansas, Pine Bluff, for a semester. I just lasted there a semester and came back and got my associates in electronics in 1983 from DeVry. Worked for Motorola. They liked their employees to show up on time, and I couldn't do that because I was trying to hang in the nightclubs, and they relieved me of my duties after about a year and a half. And I worked in a nightclub for a while, worked as a door host, and then as an assistant manager. And you know, a budding alcoholic being in charge of liquor inventory really isn't a good idea, but they didn't know that. But I mean, I stole those guys blind. I mean, I had cases of a Corona and Tanqueray, vodka in my trunk. It's like, Tone, we sure are going through a lot of. And I was like, yeah, we sure are. And I just covered up, you know, I was stealing. I just changed the numbers. Said trying to feed the beast. And still, even when that was still motivated by whatever party it was, I could be the guy that walked in with the booze. You know, still trying to be something, as literature talks about, trying to earn a reputation in my heart I knew I didn't deserve. My first trip to, dad had gotten sober, and my mother had found some other paraphernalia. My stepmother had found some paraphernalia in my bedroom, and he took me to go see the person that had helped him. And at a local hospital, a therapist, and she asked me the questions, and of course I didn't tell her the truth. I lied to her. She said, Tony, do you drink? Yes. What do you drink? Well, I drink beer. Well, how much do you drink? I just have a couple. Whatever was available. You drink any hard liquor? Yes, yeah, I like gin and tonics. Well, how much of those? Well, I just have a couple. Another lie. You know, as far as whatever I could, you know, how far my money would go or who I could con into buying me drinks. And then she asked me about some other substances, and of course I lied about those. The end of this one basically in, in May of 87, I was kicked out of a 28-day program on day 23 for horseplay, vandalism, and a whole bunch of dishonesty. And I won't go into that whole thing. If you want to hear about that later, I'll tell you about it. But I wasn't ready. I didn't think I had a problem. I thought I could unique, cute, and intellectualize my way out of it. The only reason my dad let me come back to the house is because I made a commitment that I would start going to meetings. And I lied to him that first day. I said I was going to go to a meeting, and it was May, and my buddies from high school had come back from college, and I knew they were down at the beach, and I went there instead. I'm lying right off the bat, right off the rip. So it wasn't very long after that I was, you know, back to my old stuff. In November, I hid it from them as long as I could. And there was I won't tell my dad's story, but there was an event that took place where my lies and my dishonesty, and basically the disease caught up with me, and he said, look, you know, your stepmother and I, we love you, but you can't be here and do this. You know, your mother, your stepmother and I were going to go to Las Vegas, and when we get back, we don't want you here. I don't want to know that you're in Evanston. I don't want to know that you're in Chicago. I don't want to know that you're in the state of Illinois. Why don't you go to Atlanta with your mother? You know she's always had custody of you. And I was 25 years old, and my dad was talking about custody. I got to Atlanta, and the world had just gotten really small. I couldn't see any colors anymore in anything. When I finally made the decision to come visit you guys the first time, I'm driving down the street in my mom's car. She let me borrow her car. And the best description, it felt like I had withdrawn so far into myself that I was about the size of a G.I. Joe doll in the middle of my chest, looking out of my own eyes through a periscope. It was just tunnel vision. I couldn't feel any. It was horrible. The first meeting was at the Rock of Ages Church over on Memorial Drive. And one of my buddies, well-meaning, when I told him I was coming to Atlanta, he's like, man, you need to be careful in Atlanta, because, you know, especially over there at Stone Mountain, because KKK is over there in Stone Mountain, so you need to stay away from Stone Mountain. Guess where the Rock of Ages Church was? It was in Stone Mountain. And of course, in a fearful, the insanity of my thinking and how withdrawn I was, I said, okay, I'm going to go ahead and go to this meeting, but if I walk in there and I hear yee-haw afterward, I'm getting the hell out of there. But of course, that didn't happen. But what did happen was, as I walked down those steps, and from the steps to where the meeting room was probably about where that back door was, and I could see the smoke, and I heard your laughter, and your laughter hurt. Laughter hurt. And I went in and I mumbled something about, this was my first meeting, and I went in the beginner's meeting, and a gentleman, Bill A., offered to pick me up the next day, and Bill took me into meetings almost every day for the next 2 weeks. He talked to me and showed me in the big book about, in the doctor's opinion, about the mental obsession and the physical allergy, and talked to me about a disease, and talked to me about that being powerless, meaning there's, you know, those that accepted that, you were powerless over alcohol. And it was because of that powerlessness where the unmanageability of life comes from. I wasn't honest on my inventory. I'm not going to say that's why I haven't been sober this long. I'm just a classic example of willing to follow simple suggestions. I went to a lot of meetings. At that time, that's when I got hooked up, probably with, God put me into with the best group of guys, a bunch of Nazis, AAs from the primary purpose group, and we ran around in a pack and came up here and fellowshipped and laughed together and cried together and cussed each other out and almost fought over girlfriends and all that all that craziness. I had a ball with those guys. Brothers. I just wasn't really ready to follow simple directions. And I won't go through the whole thing, but I had been in a relationship, it ended, and my sponsor at the time just simply described that as, you got two rotten fence posts holding each other up, and one of them goes away, the other one's going to fall down. I was pretty sick, spiritually sick, selfish, manipulative, dishonest, just vengeful. And she had gotten a new sponsor, worked the steps, and got away from my sick behind. God bless her. That began a series of, I'd be in for a year and then go back out 5-10 days, in for a couple of years or months, and it just bounced in and out until got into a step study group in Atlanta, and, you know, luckily I hadn't lost my job, and started working the steps, and got a promotion at work, and then another promotion, and money started getting a little bit better, and bought a house in Snellville, and something happened where Tony didn't get his way, and no acceptance, no asking God for his will to be done. God, this is what I want, make it happen. And the drinking and the other stuff, the house went away. In short, on January 1st of 2002. The power and the water had been off at the house in Snellville for about 4 months each. I had gone from probably about 195 pounds to 155 pounds. I was laying on my mother's couch, watching her cable television and eating her food, and she came out on the 1st of January, and she looked down at me, and she'd seen me kind of like this before. And then she looked at her son in that condition and said, "You need to do something." It was over. My sponsor was out of time, the one that I had, and so I called my grand sponsor, and he asked me a question. He said, "Do you have any money?" "No." "Do you have any insurance?" "No." "Do you have anyone who's willing to pay for treatment for you?" "No." He goes, "Well, there's a place in Louisville, Kentucky. It's probably not what you're used to. It's a homeless shelter with a recovery program. You got access to a computer?" "Yes." "Get their number off the internet, give them a call, and then call me back." And I called, and they said, "When can you be here?" I said, "Well, I'm in Atlanta." You know, that pitiful,
"I need help."
"Well, what kind of help?"
"I need help with alcohol and drugs."
"Well, when can you be here?"
"I'm in Atlanta."
"Well, call us back. We got a bed for you. Let us know when you can be here." And my mother, how I got to Atlanta was on a one-way plane ticket, and now how I got to Louisville was with the one. Mom bought me a one-way plane ticket to the healing place, to go to the healing place in Louisville, to go to that recovery program with the homeless shelter with a recovery program. Even being there, pure lead 12-step bottle, I relapsed twice. I spent my 40th and 41st birthdays in detox at the healing place. The last time, a gentleman who worked there as I'm sitting in detox, he looked at me, and what his job was there is that he was the overnight monitor with all the homeless men. And he talked to me about how the men, many of those men that would get a bed there every day, were one-time clients, and he'd seen them sober, and that something had happened, and that he looked in their eyes, and you could see that the light was on, but no one was home. And he said, "Tony, you know you can't survive out there, but now you're going to begin to think that this won't work for you." That's just God, because it was right spot on. It's as if he reached inside and pulled me back from that inner. Wherever you go when you're not here anymore, it's like he reached inside and pulled me back from that place, from that dark place. He made a suggestion to me about who to ask to be a sponsor, and I took that suggestion. And I don't mean to be crass, but one of the things that the phrases in the curriculum that they use there is that your life is the sum total of your actions. And at 41 years old, being in detox, if that was the sum total of my actions, I wanted something different. I wanted better. I thought of you guys. The times when I'd been up here, I thought of my buddies in Atlanta. I thought of the years my dad and his friends and it felt like I was just leaned up against a brick wall and life was passing by. Even the guys that I had been in the program with that had moved on, and they were working, or they were happy and they were doing the deal, and I was stuck. And I just knew I couldn't believe a thing that went on in my head. And you know, not to be crass, but I thought, you know, after getting my sponsors, it's like, you know, if I go number two, I need to call that man and ask him to use my right or my left hand to wipe my hiney. Because I could not trust a thing that was going on in my head anymore. And I was willing, if I was going to follow some instructions. And he asked me to start at the blank page to read the 63. And we did that, and we sat down and we had a chat about the first two proposals. And being there and attending meetings in the city in that week before we led up to that, I'd been sitting in a meeting, and a gentleman that I respected, the meeting was on the third step, and he shared that, you know, his sponsor shared with him that just as important as the day that you stop drinking and doing drugs is the day you turn your will and your life over to the care of God, and he gave that date. And I'd never heard that before, and I'd heard a lot of stuff around here, and I'd never heard that one before. I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. And then a couple days later, hear another gentleman share the same thing. And so a couple of days later, we're going to get with my sponsor, with Bird, and we kneel, and we say the third step prayer together. And he says, I want you to write this date down in your book, because just as important as the day that you stop drinking and doing drugs is the day you turn your will and your life over to the care of God. And that was on August 6th, 2003. Thorough inventory, but it was, he'd say, do this and I'll do that. And then I would do that, and then the man walked me through the deal. I don't want to get too much into it, but when I first asked him to sponsor me, and he said, start at the blank page and read to 63. He said, I also want you to begin and end your day starting on the bottom of 85 and reading through 88. And I kind of looked at him like he was nuts. He goes, what's wrong? I said, well, that's the 11th step, isn't it? And this is our first talk. You know, he was framing the relationship for me. And he looked at me and he said, is it ever too soon for you to start your relationship with God? I had to say no. I can't say I read it every day. I was sick a couple of months ago, and there were a couple of days, but I don't remember the last time that I didn't start my day with 84 through 88, and following the when we retire at night on the top of 86, and how in my day when I break consciousness, not most mornings, it is upon awakening, we ask God to direct our thinking, asking that it be divorced to self-pity, dishonest and self-seeking motives. I just try and follow the directions. The length of the program there is 6 months, and because I had been through the deal already, and they let me have a place to stay. And based on my history and my relapses, this is the room that they put me in. Chronic. That's what that was the room that I was in. I was in there with the chronic relapsers. And participating in what they asked me to participate in, but just working the steps and trying to follow the directions and trying to seek a relationship with the God of my understanding. From August 6th, with that third step, in the middle of maybe the second week of October, I was doing ninth step work, and it asked if I could go in. They have a peer mentor deal, and it's basically you teach classes and manage a caseload and kind of mentor the men who are behind you in the program, and they said that I could do that. I did that for about 9 months, and then there was a recovery house that had the pieces of that model that would fit in a halfway, three-quarter-way house environment, and went over there to be a resident manager, eventually moved up to be the manager of the house. Was there for about 3.5 years, and then I was out to lunch or dinner with some friends from the fellowship, and Buddy was the replication director at the healing place. And what Kentucky did is they took that model, that recovery model, and peer-led model, and they replicated it And they have built 10 centers in Kentucky. They've built 5 men's centers and 5 women's centers. And it's a partnership between Department of Corrections, Governor's Office of Local Area Development, and Kentucky Housing Corporation, which facilitates the Section 8 leases. And my buddy says, you know, they're building that program out in Moorhead, and I'd never heard of Moorhead. Where's, it's 2 hours east. And he said, send me your resume, because then it was time for me to do something different. I want somewhere in that first 2 weeks that I was back at the healing place, I just said, God, I'm going to stay here until you tell me otherwise. And have tried to follow that and wait on God, trying not to be quicker than God this time. And I interviewed, and there was another gentleman that interviewed at that time, and there were areas where he was strong, where I was weak, but there were areas where I was strong, where he was weak. And the executive director created a position as operations manager, and I began having the privilege of being able to participate and facilitate the same process that I went through in Louisville. Have since the program director has moved on, and I've been the program director there for about almost five and a half years now. And we try and give them the big book and just give them the deal and try and create an environment, a spiritual environment where change can take place. I work with some awesome people. You know, I'm kind of glad I was just asked yesterday so that I didn't have 6 months to obsess over this. And then, when Alcoholics Anonymous, even though I wasn't ready, Alcoholics Anonymous gave a son his father back. And then later on, that same program gave the son back to his dad. In 10 years, dad passed again in October, and mom passed in August of last year. I was able to be there for them and be present and be a member of the family. I have a half-sister, but I basically grew up an only child. And for God and this program and the steps and the fellowship to produce the change in my selfish hiney that could change me, that I could have a mate, a partner. Jen and I got married on June 1st. We've been together for, I'm going to mess it up now. What, 6 years? Yeah. That's the brains of the outfit back there, because she said the reason I picked June 1st is so you won't forget. You know, I mean, that's going to be kind of a hard date to forget. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the life beyond, given us, life beyond my wildest imagination. I was thinking about with Michelle and Marion and Mary, you guys coming to Louisville to the wedding. I mean, it's unbelievable what this program gives in the relationships and the bonds and the friendships and the love. And it's given me a sense of purpose. I can't say that I know who I am, but the steps and God has shown me and my vast experience in what not to do has definitely shown me what I'm not. And I'm cool with the rest. It's just that has just been a miracle and a blessing. Had the privilege to walk with Jen through her grandparents' death this year. We don't have any kids, except our kids are 4 legs. They got their 4 legs, and one's about 64 pounds, the other one's about 68 pounds. We got 2 standard poodles. Willing to take care of a pet. How'd that happen? You know, I love those guys. This is our boys. Just the miracle to have a purpose, to feel a part of something that, not always, but instead of being that chameleon, most times just having the ability to just be okay where I'm at. And so we were sharing in the meeting last night again, you know, Joanne, you talked about the sharing that goes on and how that touched you. And I just, as I sat over there, it was like, man, we just get up here and what comes from the heart reaches the heart. And so it is my hope that something from my heart has touched yours this evening. Again, thank you. It is a privilege to have been up here this evening. My name is Tony White. I'm an alcoholic.